Welcome, my friends. This is Henrik Palmgren, and you are listening to Red Ice Creations Radio, and we are recording from the west coast of Sweden. You will find us online at redicecreations.com. Stop by, check out our news, our radio archive, and much, much more. And you can hear us every Thursday and Sunday. And on Sundays, our program is broadcasted on bbsradio.com. Today, we are going to talk about the goddess tradition with author Karen Tate, so stay tuned for that. Thanks to one of our monthly regulars, Alan Watt, for being with us last week. Alan will be back the first Sunday next month, so stay tuned to Red Ice Creations Radio. Now, let's get today's program going. Welcome. Today we have an interesting program lined up for you. We are joined by Karen Tate, and she is the author to a book entitled Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destination. And this topic of divine feminine traditions and goddess worship is a very interesting one that keeps coming up when you study not only ancient civilizations, but also secret societies and, of course, the many different religions. And I thought it would be interesting to spend some time on this issue today with Karen. I have read about her book, and it seems to be a fascinating one, so I'm very glad that she's here with us today. So welcome to the program, Karen, and thank you for spending some time with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. This has been the passion of my life for the last 15 years, and I always enjoy speaking to anyone about it who's interested in the subject.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And by the way, before we kind of go into this, I can mention your website. It's KarenTate.com for everyone who wants to follow along during our talk here today. So, yeah, as I said, it's great to have you here. And to kind of kick things off, why don't we begin to, maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself and how you began your research in this field.
Well, I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, which is sort of referred to in the United States as the Bible Belt, because it's predominantly Catholic and Baptist. You won't find many people who are interested in the divine feminine. In fact, I went my entire life until I moved to California without even meeting anyone whose religion was Judaism. Mm. So it sort of gives you an idea of the background, that I come from, that narrow, Christian fundamentalist sort of background. But to be honest with you, it never really clicked with me. It was just really sort of a Sunday obligation, and I just could never get into the icon of Jesus on the cross at the front of the church.
Yeah.
I want my God or my goddess to be, loving and nurturing, and the suffering and the sacrifice aspect just didn't feel like it was in keeping with the joy of life. And I don't know, I say that in retrospect now. I honestly don't think I thought much about it when I was younger, because it just didn't feel integral to my life. Mm. I was more interested as a young person in ancient cultures and metaphysics. And to be honest with you, I was really sort of an oddball on the fringe where I lived, because there weren't a lot of people that were interested in that sort of stuff. And it actually took my husband and I, when I was 30, I moved to California, and my eyes just opened. I was exposed to so much more than I would have ever been exposed to living in New Orleans. And that's when I stumbled on to goddess spirituality, because even in the colleges, in the part of the United States where I live, they really didn't treat this as a potential viable spirituality for contemporary times. At best, they talked about it in the context of Greek mythology, that had no bearing on today or any bearing on hope for the future.
Hmm. So you mentioned California during your school years, I guess. What was it there that opened up your eyes about this?
Well, when we moved out here, I was 30, and I actually took an adult education class that sort of opened my eyes to the idea of the divine feminine. And then, you know, I just started to read everything I could get my hands on. I think the two best books that started me down the path were Merlin Stone's When God Was a Woman and Rhianne Eisler's Chalice and the Blade.
Yeah, yeah.
And once I read those two books, I was hooked. Because, you know, then this wasn't just a feminist fantasy. You know, this wasn't just something for ancient times. I realized that there was a whole history that, you know, I wasn't even taught in school, you know, of what came before patriarchal religion.
Yeah.
And that there was really a feminine face of God out there that, you know, that was legitimate and viable and maybe offered a better alternative than what we have now,
yeah,
a dominating society.
I mean, that's an interesting subject, of course, the obvious suppression of the goddess. And do you think that this is something that only have been, you know, predominant in the, like, latest 2,000 years, I guess?
Well, Maria Gimbutas talks about the Kurgan hordes that came down and over thousands of years either obliterated or assimilated cultures that were more matrifocal. And, you know, I know she tends to be controversial to a certain extent because she made, she made a lot of, drew a lot of conclusions that, you know, everyone doesn't agree with.
Mm.
But, you know, the archaeological evidence is there that, 20 and 30,000 years ago, people were worshiping a female god.
Mm.
And, you know, it became about power and politics. I mean, there's some scholars that I've been reading about recently that talk about you follow the blood and you follow the demise of women. And, you know, it's an interesting theory because in the earliest of times, women's blood, particularly their menstrual blood, was looked at as a life-giving force.
Mm, yeah.
Pharaohs and kings coveted it. Some people, you know, even erroneously thought that it could give them immortality. So basically, it started out as something coveted. And I think what happens is when someone covets something and they can't create it or they can't control it, well, what do? Then they don't want the power to be in someone else's hands.
Hmm.
So they demean that.
Yeah.
You know, they subjugate it. So I think goddess, and by association, women and their reproductive abilities and their menstrual bloods, you know, suddenly became taboo.
Yeah.
And, you know, in men's quest to, you know, subjugate women. And, I mean, we all know in the ancient world, marriage was little more than, you know, an ownership contract.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a partnership.
Hmm. Very interesting. And how far back do you think we have to go if we are to, you know, pick up the latest traces of a more, you know, matriarchy or that kind of predominant ruling of a society or civilization?
Well, we think that there was matriarchal societies, or I want to say matrifocal societies, and possibly Knossos, Greece, on Crete.
Yeah.
We think Chateau Hayuk in Turkey. There's evidence that there were matrifocal societies in China.
Hmm.
I mean, I think they existed in a lot of places. It's just, you know, sometimes it's difficult to determine that. But whether the societies were matrifocal or not, certainly it's becoming a more contemporary understanding, even by conservative archaeologists, that these artifacts we're finding really weren't just ancient Barbie dolls.
Hmm.
They are finally coming to believe that these were artifacts that represented worship of a goddess. And the three reasons they give is number one, these female artifacts were found in such abundance compared to artifacts that represented the male.
Yeah.
They were found in places that were believed to be the sacred part of these ancient compounds. They were made in using materials that was the best the people had at the time, and they believed by their best craftspeople of the time. So you put all of this together, and you know, some of these artifacts that you might just see in a museum labeled fertility object, they really need to be renamed in a lot of cases and called, at the very least, Mother Goddess.
Yeah.
You know, if we don't actually know a name because it's too old.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, archaeologists are starting to agree that you know, the Mother Goddess culture dates back 20,000 to 30,000 years.
So we're
even before male deity.
Yeah.
You know, and it's easy to understand, really. You know, as people started to, you know, have a sense of themselves and their world around them. You know, it was the female, you know, that could give birth. You know, it the female animals, the female humans, you know, they could bleed and not die.
Yeah.
You know, they were the ones that, you know, they didn't understand man's part in procreation yet, you know.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, it made sense to them, you know, that the creatrix of the world was female, because, you know, obviously they saw that's where new life, you know, came from, the female's loins.
Yeah. Do you think that there could be also a connection to, you know, the ancients viewing the cosmos in terms of, I guess, astrotheology, viewing the cosmos as the, you know, the ultimate mother goddess, basically?
Well, I think so. And, you know, and I think as people get more more open and more advanced, I personally believe that whatever the supreme source is, whatever we want to label it, you know, it's probably really a balance of masculine and feminine energy.
Yeah.
You know, I think it would be a cruel joke on either gender or deity to just be male or just be female.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I really tend to think it's much more of a blending, or I don't know if you want to call it sort of an androgynous.
Yeah.
Sort of energy. That would be the only thing that would really truly make sense. Otherwise, you know, you would be discriminating against the only other gender on the planet. And
yeah.
I don't think a deity in their ultimate wisdom would be so foolish.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's an interesting point. I mean, do you know, or rather, what's your theory about that? I mean, obviously, of course, we have, you know, the question of procreation in regards to why we have, you know, kind of divided up ourselves, I guess, into these different genders. But I mean, could you refer to this on a more spiritual level, that there is a kind of a, you know, battle going on between the cosmic forces that have kind of divided themselves up, you know, in these two parts all the time that we see?
Well, you know, honestly, my best answer to that is I think the division is man-made, human-made. I think all the division in the world is human-made. You know, it's too many people who think theirs is the only religion, theirs is the only way. Everything else is valueless or not the real deal. You know, I don't think it's the divinities or the divine that have this cosmic battle going on. It's just my personal opinion that's totally a man-made construct.
Yeah.
You know, it's about power over. You know, it's I have the keys to heaven, and everybody else is doomed.
Yeah.
You know, and if everybody thinks you really have the keys to heaven, well, you're an awfully powerful, wise person, and everybody's going to be flocking to you, aren't they?
Yeah.
You
know, yeah.
I think it's more about ego and power than it is about you know, what was really intended for human beings.
Mm. Ah, that's a Very, very nice answer. Very, very. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, then we have, you know, in regards to, I guess, more modern religion, the Catholic religion. I mean, they have the stuff like the, you know, the two Marys, I guess. And isn't this kind of like traits of the ancient the goddess religion, basically?
Oh, absolutely. And I wish more Catholics or Christians understood that, because we have to thank those people who insisted on keeping Mary and Mary Magdalene alive, for keeping the energy of the feminine alive.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there was a point in time when Christianity and paganism were battling it out, and obviously Christianity won.
Mm-hmm.
And it got to the point where if you still wanted to worship the mother goddess, well, that could mean a death sentence to you.
Yeah.
So, you know, people were forced to conform or die, you know.
Yeah.
And but I think people never really gave up their need for the mother. You know, I think
yeah.
it's a very primal need.
Yeah.
And so they saw the mother in Mary, Jesus's mother, or in Mary Magdalene. And really, if you look at Mary and Mary Magdalene, if you could put the two of them together, you'd have a whole woman. You know,
yeah, yeah.
The church got so weird about sexuality, you know, and anything that was sexual was taboo. So, you know, Mary had, you know, Jesus had to be an immaculate conception because,
yeah.
You know, because sexuality was such a dirty thing.
Yeah.
Where before, you know, procreation and giving life was something joyous. It wasn't something taboo or dirty,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
So if you combine the sexuality of Mary Magdalene with the virtues of the Blessed Mother, then you have a whole woman.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I mean that's my take on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I you know, so I think through Mary and Mary Magdalene there's a bridge of understanding of commonality where, you know, people who want to be a goddess advocate and embrace the sacred feminine
mm-hmm.
can find some sort of common ground with the patriarchal, you know, with patriarchal Christianity.
Yeah. I've heard other researchers point out, you know, that I guess you could say that modern Christianity have kind of also tried to replace, I guess, people's need for the divine feminine in that sense, that they even refer to the church as the mother's church, and basically you have guys dressing up in gowns and stuff like this. I mean, what's your idea about that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you look at the Holy Trinity. It's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Mm.
Okay. Well, if you just are spoon-fed from the pulpit, you don't know that the Holy Spirit, in the very beginning, was genderless and or feminine. It wasn't until later, when things got transcribed, that it became masculine.
Mm.
I mean, the Holy Spirit, or Sophia, again, I'll repeat, was either gender neutral or feminine. In fact, there's some ancient text that connect Isis, Egyptian goddess Isis,
yeah.
as being connected to Sophia, or Holy Wisdom.
Mm.
So, you know, so you have the Trinity, you know, that was corrupted.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, very early pagan trinities, you know, they didn't not have a woman in the Trinity. I mean, you know, they didn't have a problem with the idea that, you know, it took a man and a woman for life to, you know, for life to be created. You look at Kali and Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, he is dormant unless she activates him.
Hmm.
Even in the Kabbalah, it's about, you know, bringing the Shekinah and the masculine into balance. I mean, these old concepts were there, but it didn't serve the church. You know, it didn't serve the church, who wanted to keep women out of leadership.
Hmm.
And I mean, if you believe some of the you know, like the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, I mean, it might be that Jesus intended for her to lead his church.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we have scriptures that show us that some of the apostles were misogynist. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't want to share leadership with women. They wanted it to be a good old boys club.
Yeah, yeah. Fascinating. And of course, you mentioned ISIS there, and also of course Sophia. But do you think that kind of all this began in Egypt with the idea of ISIS?
You know, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, I think things were probably happening simultaneously in places. I mean, you have Astarte and Inanna happening in the Mesopotamian. Mm. You know, you have things going on in India. You know, I think she is one of the oldest of the old goddesses. I mean, she's connected in a lot of sense. Through the Venus star and everything.
Yeah.
I think things over time got so blended and so conflated that it's hard to know, but in reality it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Because I think whether, you know, you call the sacred feminine Mary or Kali or Isis or Kuan Yin or Spider Grandmother or Saint Anne. Mm. You know, I think it doesn't really matter what you call her or what her face looks like. You know,
yeah.
I think it's the essence of the sacred feminine that we've lost in the world.
Mm.
And I think that's why the world is in such chaos.
Hmm. So for the sake of the question, I mean, how would we be could we be helped more if we were to return to this goddess worship?
I do believe that.
Mm.
And I don't, you know, and if it's hard for somebody to swallow, you know, to think of it in terms of goddess worship, if that's just too extreme for them, think of it in ideological concepts. For instance, Rhianne Eisler writes about the partnership way, and she talks about how we believe possibly in these matrifocal ancient societies where goddess was revered. These weren't, and Myriad Gimbutas talks about this too, that these weren't societies that were based on power over and warfare.
Yeah.
They maybe were more interested in, you know, taking care of their own and enlightenment and spirituality and beauty.
Yeah.
It wasn't about dominance and control. So just imagine for a minute, and you know, when I give these sorts of sermons at church sometimes, you know, I said, you know, don't think about goddess for a minute. Don't think about any of that. Just think about how it would be nice if our world would be different if when our sons grew up, they weren't taught that man is entitled to exploit nature.
Mm.
That they were taught that we are stewards of the earth,
yeah.
Not nature is there for us to, you know, it's an unlimited resource and it's there to use until it's gone.
Hmm.
You know,
yeah.
What if we were taught that, it was more important to make sure everybody in the world had food and the proper education than, you know, being concerned about, boundaries and who's got the most power and who has the biggest stick out there in the world to, you know, dominate people,
yeah.
And make sure they did our bidding.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what if we grew up, we grew our children to think war is the absolute last alternative to any situation,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I really do believe if there were more women in power, it would be less likely our sons and daughters would be sent out there so easily on such a whim,
yeah.
And become cannon fodder.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
It's just a different mentality.
And
I think these mentalities reflect the sacred feminine.
Mm-hmm.
So would it be so hard to embrace the sacred feminine if that's what it meant for the world?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We would be responsible environmentalists. We wouldn't have war. We were concerned about education and poverty.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds like, you know, that sounds like nirvana to me. I don't know. You know, I mean, that's sort of the way I approach people when they say, oh, this is just a feminist fantasy.
Hmm.
And I say, but it isn't, you know. And even if ancient cultures didn't profess these ideas,
yeah.
you know, our destiny is not written. It's we're, you know, it isn't predetermined. We can make these changes if enough of us just demanded it.
Yeah, yeah. Are you? Do you consider that we, you know, at the time we're currently in, do you think that we are approaching a more balanced world at this point?
Well, you know, you look at the news, and excuse me, you look at idiots like George Bush and his administration, and you wonder, you know. I mean, you know, this. There's so much that seems to go on in our world. You know, the average person seems at the mercy of the powers that be.
Mm.
But you know, I think there's a grassroots growth that's happening. You know, I think more and more women are realizing that they have to step up. I mean, change happens slowly. I mean, I don't,
yeah.
you know, I don't think this is going to happen tomorrow. I mean, I hope I see it in my lifetime.
Hmm.
But I think there are more people becoming concerned that, you know, the hands, you know, the power can't be in so few hands. That, you know, there are other values that we need to be concerned about other than, you know, the ones that seem to be, you know, at the forefront today.
Yeah, yeah. So, I think there is a real possibility that, you know, Hillary Clinton may be running for president in 2008. What's your take on that?
You know, I don't know. People have asked me that, and I want to be certain to say that just because a candidate is a woman doesn't automatically make them the best candidate.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
I mean,
sure.
I think if Al Gore had won the election, and a lot of people believe he did win the election, I don't think we would be in this war in Iraq. You know,
hmm.
and I don't think our country would be in the financial shape it's in, and
hmm.
we wouldn't, you know, have lost so many lives, and there probably wouldn't be the turmoil in the Middle East
yeah.
if George Bush hadn't got into office.
Hmm.
And I don't mean to be political, but you know, it's hard not to be political.
Yeah, sure,
because you know, it affects spirituality
yeah.
because. You know, I mean, the Bush administration doesn't even recognize paganism as a religion.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, even though the United States is founded on freedom of religion, there's so much hypocrisy.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I digress.
No problem.
I mean, I think she's brilliant. I think she's capable. You know, I just wonder if she's got the backbone to do what's right and not toe the party line and be politically correct. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm too idealistic, but I think by the time people reach the point in the political system in the United States that they can really be considered as a candidate, they have to bend and twist themselves so much to please so many people that, you know, it's hard to be true to themselves. I mean, I remember when Clinton, her husband, was first in office and she tried to get health care reform.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I admired her for that. Maybe it was a little naive, but I admired her for that.
Mm.
She wrote a great book about It Takes a Village to Raise a Child. I mean, I think she has the knowledge and the will, but would she be allowed to carry that forth? I don't know.
Mm.
You know, that's what concerns me.
Yeah.
So I don't have a definitive answer
yeah, sure.
for you, but that goes for anyone, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that goes for anyone, you know, who's running for office. I don't think they can. We ever really know who they really are, and
yeah.
If they can really be themselves when they get in the office because they owe too many favors.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I asked the question also because of, you know, not of because actually who is sitting in office, because on some levels I don't think that is the point basically. I don't know if, you know, George Bush actually decides over the entire country and so forth, but who knows. My point anyway was that it could be kind of like a almost like a reflection or a communication in that sense, that we are approaching some kind of change if we have a woman in as the president in the United States, I guess.
Well, possibly. And I think that would be a great step forward. I mean, you know, I hate to say this, you know, because I know I'm probably talking to a European or an international audience. But, you know, sometimes I really feel ashamed to be an American, because some of the Americans are so isolated from what goes on in the rest of the world. And sometimes I think, you know, when, you know, religion holds a lot of people in America back. You know, a lot of these religious fundamentalists, these right-wing people, you know, believe that women shouldn't be in office.
Yeah.
You know, they should still be home with the kids. And, and man has this right to rule the roost, and his wife isn't really a true partner. I can't see those types of people voting for a woman.
Yeah.
Now, I hope they prove me wrong. I mean, I really do. But I don't know, you know, I'm fearful that there are enough of them around to stop progress.
Yeah. Yeah, let's see what happens on that front. I mean, it's interesting to get your take on it. But I want to return now a little bit to your book, of course. It's called Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. And I'm curious about the number, of course, 108. And does this refer to the, I guess, movements or names of Shiva?
Well, there's a lot of different significances to 108. It's sort of numerically, it's a sacred number. I believe that there are 108 aspects of, I believe it's Kali. There are some people that make, 108 pilgrimages. I mean, from culture to culture, there are a lot of different significances, you know. So I just sort of answered that in general by saying it's a universally sacred number, you know, and it varies from tradition to tradition. And actually, this book is it's the next in a series of travel books that my publisher published. And mine's a little bit different from the rest of the travel series, where, you know, his are much more just your traditional sacred sites. These are all just sacred feminine sites. But that doesn't mean that some of the sites, you know, aren't a place where God was also worshipped as well. I mean, like the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, for instance, is one of the sites in the book. But I really think of it as more of an encyclopedia of goddess culture around the world, because even if you don't intend or don't have the money to go to these places, it's a real eye-opener once you see how prevalent goddess has been and is across the world. I don't think a lot of people, especially in the West, really know that. And I'm really happy that the book is on mainstream bookshelves and not just metaphysical bookshelves or women's studies bookshelves, you know, because I think it's going to bring the idea of goddess and the sacred feminine to people that didn't know, just like me. I mean, I was really angry that I didn't find out about the sacred feminine until I was 30 years old. But rather late than never. So the book, it has 108 different sacred sites across all the different continents, with hundreds of other references to other sites thrown in that the reader can use as a springboard to research other places. There's also a section in it called Gaia Alerts, which talk about environmental issues that are happening in different parts of the world, because goddess is Mother Nature. And also goddess focused side panels, which explain things to people about goddess spirituality that they might be confused about, like sacred sex or sacred prostitution, and who's Maria Gimbutas, and who was the Queen of Sheba, and, you know, just a lot of different things that there's a lot of misinformation about out there that may have something to do with, you know, goddess or the sacred feminine.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, you know, regarding a sacred site, what kind of defines a sacred site? What is it, basically?
Well, you know, some of these places are sacred sites because of, you know, people over time have believed that they're, excuse me, are particularly powerful, like energy vortexes or ley lines or something like that. But I didn't necessarily focus on that to choose the sites, although some of the places do happen to coincide with these naturally occurring phenomena.
Mm.
I focused on, you know, I took different, you know, traditions and religions and spiritualities around the world. And you know, these places are sacred because at some point during our, you know, mankind's history, we determined they were sacred.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, the Temple of Artemis in Ephesus, Turkey. In the very beginning, Artemis was revered as a tree. And from a tree, it went to different versions of statues and temples. And, you know, so over time, it's changed. But, you know, we retained the site where it was. And I think these places over time of people coming there and focusing, you know, their psychic energy, their spiritual energy, these places sometimes, you know, become power spots.
Mm.
You know, I've been on tours with people who were psychic, and they believe that they can feel, you know, a difference in energy, you know, at these places.
Yeah.
You know, that's very subjective.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
You know, I'm not going to say that's absolute, but
yeah.
I think it's as much belief and faith as it is an actual physical power that you feel there.
Yeah. Interesting. And, you know, could it be that the location has been part of a human, you know, ancestors keep on coming back to the site, and with time this kind of gives the location, you know, and I guess a spiritual atmosphere, basically.
Oh yeah, I mean, like Chartres Cathedral in France. I mean, the site of Chartres Cathedral started out as a sacred site of the Druids. And Christianity comes along, and they want to convert the Druids and the pagans, so they build a church on top of the Druid sacred site.
Exactly.
I mean, it happened all through history. I mean, you can see it today at some of the sacred sites in Egypt. On top of the Egyptian temples, you will find a Coptic church, for instance. At Eleusis, in Greece, sacred to the goddess Demeter and Persephone, you can see a church on top of this hill that's actually a cave, which was part of the Eleusinian mysteries, and where they believed you could enter the underworld.
Yeah.
So, you know, as one religion, you know, was phased out and another religion came into power, they just built on top of the same sites. Not just for political reasons, you know, to convert the devoted, but I think it, you know, consciously or not, you know, I mean, these spots then became containers for this potent sacred energy.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And by the way, are there any, considering that we are up here in Sweden, are there any Nordic places that you talk about in the book?
You know, honestly, I don't. I didn't make it to Sweden, but, you know, you have all the Viking Freya, you know, tradition up there. I'm sure there probably are. And if I get a chance to do a second edition, I really do want to spend more time in Europe because my publisher wanted me to write, you know, to cover, you know, just about every continent that was possible.
Yeah.
So I really didn't get a chance to do as much as I would have liked in Europe. I mean, you know, there are countries that I could have done 108 sites.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was really difficult choosing 108 sites just, you know, around the world. It was brutal.
I can understand that. You know, another thing that's pretty interesting, and this is of course regarding, I don't know if this is the correct term for it, but I guess it is a goddess called Columbia, and many people have referred this to, you know, the Statue of Liberty and this kind of stuff. Have you researched this at all?
Well, I don't know about Columbia, but what I do know is that in my book, I actually, I encourage people to rethink and redefine the sacred feminine and what is the sacred feminine. And one of the places I recommend we start claiming as a sacred site is the Statue of Liberty in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not just fantasy that I pulled out of the air. There's actually historic precedent for that, because in Rome, they deified virtues. And if you, you know, you go to a lot of Gothic cathedrals, you'll find a lot of virtues, or, you know, they have made them saints,
mm-hmm.
or, and they're always feminine, you know.
Yeah.
But to go back to Lady Liberty, she was called in ancient Rome Lady Libertas.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
on the Aventine Hill in Rome, they actually had a temple built in her honor. So as a contemporary political goddess, I recommend that people look at the Statue of Liberty and allow her to be an effigy for the sacred feminine, for liberty. And what has happened is, over time, her effigy has been used over and over again by people who have been felt downtrodden, you know,
mm.
who have felt oppressed. For instance, when they had the big, overthrow in Tiananmen Square in China,
mm-hmm.
the students that were revolting against the government had a huge effigy of the Statue of Liberty that they carried,
hmm.
Carried with them in their riots, or their protests.
Yeah.
So, so I can say that, but I haven't researched the aspect of, did you call it, Columbia?
Yeah, Columbia, the goddess Columbia. I don't know if that's the correct term, so to speak, for it, but that's what I've heard. But yeah, I just wanted to ask you about that.
So.
What's that? Sorry.
I'll have to look that up.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It may be a new avenue to travel down.
Yeah, it might be. Sure. I mean, this is of course regarding the basic, when you see Columbia pictures, if you ever go to the movies, they got this, the goddess.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she has
got
the torch in her hand. And the,
piqued my curiosity now.
Yeah, of course. And this is, of course, related to, you know, the torch of liberty, which, of course, has to do with Libertas. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. And by the way, you mentioned, you know, Gothic cathedrals also. There, I think it is in the Gothic cathedrals that there are a lot of what is referred to as Black Madonnas, right?
Oh, yeah.
What's that all about?
Okay, Black Madonnas. You find a lot of those in France, Spain, Sicily, Italy. They tend to be, and they're like in France and Germany, too. They tend to be a lot around even Poland, around the Mediterranean area, but I think that's where they are predominantly, but you find a lot of them in other places in Europe as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are different schools of thought on it. Some people say that these are images that came out of Africa, thus
yeah.
the skin is dark. Some say they're associated with the goddess Isis from Egypt or the goddess Artemis from Turkey, thus their skin is dark.
Yeah.
They believe, though, that it was in these dark Madonnas, they're either black or brown, that the sacred, these were different because the sacred feminine or the goddess was actually embodied in these statues. It was almost like the goddess was hiding in plain sight.
Hmm.
The goddess is associated sometimes with these earthly, underground, chthonic aspects,
yeah.
which, are associated with the darkness of the earth, the richness of the soil, the fertility therein.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
So hence, she is dark. And a lot of people don't, especially, Caucasians, they don't realize that a lot of the people from the Mediterranean area, from the Middle East area, their skin is dark.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so silly when we see these pictures of Jesus and he has a white face.
Yep.
You know, we've sort of homogenized a lot of the characters, I think, that come out of that Middle Eastern Mediterranean region as if they're they're blind and blue-eyed,
kind of
thing, you know. And I mean, and I'm blind and blue-eyed, but and I think as a child growing up, I didn't know that Jesus would not have had white skin. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah.
The idea of the color of the skin.
Mm.
They're from, they tend to come from that region. And there were actually these Black Madonna statues that some found when they removed some of the top layers of paint that they actually sometimes were Isis statues.
Oh, really?
So there's that part of it. There's the element of it that, the goddess stayed alive, the sacred feminine stayed alive in plain sight in these statues. And these statues, to a certain extent, are a thorn in the side of the church because they know that a lot of people connect these Black Madonnas with Goddess.
Yeah.
And, the church doesn't want to, they want to suppress that.
Yeah.
Also, too, most of these Madonnas and Child, you go back and it's pretty clear that Jesus sitting on Mary's lap, that iconic image, was actually borrowed, stolen, co-opted, whatever you want to say, from Isis holding Horus, her son, her lap. You know, it was this idea of, again, converting the pagans, because Isis was such a powerful goddess, fledgling Christianity had a hard time dethroning her. They were using an image that was familiar to the pagans and using it in a Christian image to, for familiarity, to sway them over. But the church says that the Black Madonnas have this dark skin because it's candle soot. But it's so absurd, because how could it be candle soot if it's only the hands and the face and the skin that's been dirty?
Yeah, sure.
And it's not the clothing or the rest of the image around it. But they're the church and they speak, so they think people have no critical thinking skills.
Yeah, exactly. some have suggested that the Sphinx in Giza actually is a depiction of an African woman. What's your idea about that? Have you researched the Sphinx at all or looked at it?
Well, I'll tell you. I don't think the face that's on it now was the original face.
Yeah.
I think that's why it's so out of proportion with the rest of the body. But I haven't heard that. So I really can't comment.
Gotcha.
It would not surprise me at all to find out that the Sphinx really is probably much older than we think,
based on
some of those geologists who talk about water erosion.
Sure, yeah.
I hope we find out one day what the face was.
Yeah.
It's probably hidden in the Vatican vault somewhere.
Yeah, it probably is. It's very interesting to kind of get to the bottom of this and to actually find out what actually was going on down there. And of course, a lot of other different places around the earth, too. And, you mentioned, before this, you talked a little bit about Gaia and Mother Earth. And do you know kind of why this is? Why we have this current theme that our Earth actually is feminine in nature?
Well, I think it's because man doesn't give birth. It's just that simple. I think it's just it's just a very basic tenet that it is the female that births things, whatever it is, and the earth, which provides everything we need for sustenance.
Yeah.
I think that by association it becomes female not male.
Yeah. In some instances, I guess the son has been referred to as a more male deity in that sense. Do you agree on that?
Well, sometimes, but you know, there are some sun goddesses. Like, for instance, Amaterasu in Japan. She's a Shinto deity. Mm. And there's still a lot of Japanese that are Shinto in faith. I mean, just like the Mecca, the Muslims have to go to Mecca once in their lifetime, the Shinto have to go to Issei. In Japan, to Amaterasu's incredibly gorgeous sacred compound. Hmm. But she was a sun goddess, and she was believed to be the primary goddess of all the Shinto goddesses. She ruled over all the gods and goddesses of the Shinto faith.
Hmm.
So there are sun goddesses. I think there's actually... I'm really reaching back into my memory here, but I think there's also a European sun goddess as well. But her name escapes me at the moment.
Yeah.
You're right, though. It is more often you find the sun is a male deity than a female deity, but it's not absolute.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. And, you know, we have just about 3 minutes or so left here, and this has been a fascinating discussion. And, we have to do this again sometime, but before we kind of finish off here, why don't you tell us about a little bit more about your book and how we can get it and so forth, and also mention your website again.
Okay, well, the website is www.karentate.com. The book is available through Amazon.com and a lot of online booksellers. Do you have access to that there?
I think probably Amazon.com in UK is the best place, probably.
Okay.
Is it available at Amazon.com?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's available at Amazon.com, and if somebody wants to email me, if they're having problems finding it, I can find out where in their country it's available.
Mm.
I actually just found out the book is probably going to be translated into Russian next year.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Great.
So, yeah, so go to the website, www.karentate.com. From there, you can email me if you're having any problems. But I think, I think Amazon is probably the best online source.
Mm.
Or you might be able to order it from a local bookstore if, I'm not sure where your listeners are listening from.
It's pretty sporadic around Europe, but also in a few listeners in the U.S., so it's really worldwide, I guess, basically.
Yeah, I believe it is available worldwide.
Yeah. So, by the way, you just to finish off here, you also arrange, travels and have workshops and stuff like this, correct?
Yes, I do. I give lectures and slideshows, and I'm available to people to lead their group tour if they have a group of people that are interested in the sacred feminine and, they would like to go to some of these places. I can also help put a tour together as long as they actually have a group.
Yeah.
Because what you find is if you take just a traditional tour, you're not going to hear about this. For instance, I know for a fact if you go down to Malta, south of Italy, the tour guides tell people that, these statues that they're looking at aren't goddesses. They're sumo wrestlers. I know if you go to Egypt, you're going to hear about the pharaohs, and you're going to hear about the mummies, but you're not going to hear about the goddesses.
Exactly.
So you really do have to take a tour that's specific to this subject. Otherwise, you're just going to get sort of the patriarchal, traditional history of the place.
Yeah.
You're not going to get the sacred feminine aspect of it.
Yeah. So again, everyone, check out KarenTate.com for the book and much more information about Karen and her research. So again, Karen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, I really enjoyed it, and I'm happy to come back again if you'll have me.
Thank you.
Welcome. Welcome.
Thanks to everyone for listening, and thanks to Fredrik Palmgren behind the controls. We will be back again on Thursday with Donald Scott talking about the electric universe. And now, for our subscribers, we are going to talk with Michael Tesserian on technology, transhumanism, cyborgs, and AI, and much, much more. So, our subscribers, join us for an excellent conversation with Michael Tesserian. And if you're not a subscriber to redicecreations.com, please consider signing up with us and you'll get full access to our archive. This is also the best way to support this radio show and the website. Okay, we will talk again soon. This is Henrik Palmgren. Take care.